Matthew McVarish. I'm the European Ambassador for Stop the Silence, Stop Child Sexual Abuse, and this is episode 12 of the Road to Change podcast, the 10,000 mile walk to stop the silence and stop child sexual abuse. Right now, I'm by the side of the road in Bulgaria with Stego MacGyver.
Good day.
How are you feeling today, Stego?
Oh, I'm alright. We're heading to Greece now. We're only 6 kilometres away from the border.
6 kilometres. So we're recording this in Bulgaria, and by the time it's broadcast, we'll be in Greece.
Yeah.
So that'll be country number 20 by tonight. So, yeah, I mean, we've got daylight for another 3 hours, so...
Yeah, so we're...
Once we've sent this to Tom Urey for editing, I'll just get back on the road again.
On the road again?
I'll just keep walking for another couple of hours.
Yeah.
But it's been a tough week, hey, Stego? It's quite different kind of walking here
in
Bulgaria.
It has, yeah. I mean, it's quite beautiful, the scenery.
It is.
But... the roads are dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I almost feel like when they built this road, they didn't imagine that a guy in a kilt would one day want to walk down. So it's like, come on, where's the foresight? But most of the time when I'm walking in these countries, you know, there's the old road, and then you can tell that when they joined the EU, a lot of money got invested and they built these new roads. So there's two roads parallel, and I get to walk on the older one, which is kind of quiet. But but here... because it's through the mountains, I guess that they've just invested a lot of money reinforcing the one road that is through the mountains.
Yeah.
Which means, you know, it's pretty precarious. There's no space at the side.
Well, the roads are good for me to drive on, but
yeah.
it's bushes and trees covering all the sides, so, I mean...
there is no space.
When you get to the turn, it's just...
a lot of blind corners.
Yeah.
It's holding me up because I can't... obviously, safety first. I'm walking... yeah. First of all, I don't want to get killed, but I think more than that, I don't want any driver to be startled by seeing a man in a kilt standing there, because I'm covered in high-vis clothing as well as a kilt. You can't miss me.
Well, no.
Hopefully you can miss me in your car, that's the point. You don't actually hit me, but I don't want to startle anyone, so I have to walk very carefully, trying to be visible, and if you imagine, in 100 yards, I'll stop every 10 yards and have to step as close as I can to the wall or the barrier, trying to get out the car's way. It doesn't sound very safe, and it isn't. But once I've done it, I've done it, you know. But we're nearly through the mountains, we're nearly into Greece. But the other thing that's weird here is that you forget, and this is something that I haven't had to deal with before, is that we're so high above sea level.
Yeah, I felt that too.
It's really hard to go fast. I normally, you know, in Romania I was walking 7 kilometres an hour. But here, once I get up to about 5 kilometres an hour, you know, I'm knackered. So I'm only managing about 45 kilometres a day instead of over 50, because I just feel so heavy.
Yeah.
And it is literally that thing of there's not enough oxygen in the air. It's really weird. These are things that I'm learning as I go, and I hadn't really worked out that that's what the problem was. But so that's been fun, but we're still on schedule.
Oh, yeah. We're still... I think we will have at least 2.5 days to spare.
Yeah, we'll get to Athens on time, you know, because it's always planned expecting there to be some kind of new unforeseen hold-up. So, we're on schedule, and we're on it. But, saw my first tortoise this week.
Yeah.
I've seen loads now, but when I saw the first one, I just went, wow, there's a tortoise walking down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And it is funny, because, like, I think I said on Facebook, it just makes me realise how far I've walked. Now that the wildlife I'm seeing is... I saw a bat today.
A bat?
Poor wee bat on the road. I think you get bats in Ireland and Scotland, so... I think so. I don't know. I'm not a wildlife expert. I haven't walked in Scotland that much. But, that's one of the things that gradually changes, and if you pay attention to it, you just see... you know, you see how far I've walked now, because it's nearly... just under 7,000 kilometres.
Yeah.
And
I think when we arrive in Athens, I will have done 10,000... so, 6,000 miles, anyone?
6,000 miles in advance.
Since beginning of October.
And that's kind of, I mean, I walk an average of, you know, 40, 50 kilometres a day, but Stego usually does double that, because you'll drive up and down the road looking for me when I'm lost.
Yeah, when your phone's died.
When my phone's died, and you don't know which turning I've taken, and all the fun of this project.
Yeah. It's an adventure. I love it, but...
it isn't it? Well, so, I mean, as you know, listeners, I walk every day, and gradually I'm walking all the way around the continent of Europe. Stego is, well, we say follow driver, but generally you're ahead of me. So yeah. I follow you. That's practically how it works.
Yeah.
And the third member of the Road to Change team is Amanda, Amanda's already in Athens. She goes ahead on the train or flight or whatever. She goes straight to the city that I'm walking to and collaborates with the British Embassy to reach out to, you know, so when I get there, I can speak to government ministers and press and media and try and affect as much change as we can for, you know, child sexual abuse prevention across Europe. And that, it was a really simple plan, but so far it's working.
Yeah.
Slowly but surely.
Yeah.
I guess wins the race, isn't it? That's what I was told. I'm always going to think of Bulgaria now when I think of tortoises. But so, Stiggle, we put out to Facebook, and I thought with this being a podcast...
Yeah, let's use it as a tool to reach people and help them.
Well, we're trying to encourage discussion of child sexual abuse, and I haven't really... In my blogs, I talk about it, and I talk about memories and stuff, but I haven't really used this medium to really talk about what it's been like for me as a survivor. And I was thinking, because when we started the podcast, the first one I interviewed you about what it's like to be the road coordinator. Mm. Following week, I interviewed Mandy Bobs about, you know, all the logistical side that she does. And then we interviewed Dr. Pine, and I was thinking, nobody
interviews you.
I didn't interview myself and say, this is why I'm doing Road to Change. After a while, I thought maybe I should explain to people what I'm doing here, why I'm choosing to do this crazy project. So we put out on Facebook saying, anyone get any questions? And you guys, as always, were very supportive, and we've got a bunch of really interesting questions. So, Stiggle, you want to take it away?
Yeah. So, Philip Kingscott, what led to the idea of Road to Change? And have you had little luck speaking with foreign governments, so decided to speak to them in person?
Kinda. What led to the idea for Road to Change? Well, I think a whole bunch of factors led to me deciding to walk around Europe to raise awareness of child sexual abuse. And I think it's funny when I look back over my life, because a lot of things were pointing towards me doing this huge, big journey. That when I look back, makes sense why I came to this kind of decision. I think the idea to walk around Europe for this reason happened 2 years before the road started. So it was like summer 2011 when I decided to do this project. It took about 2 years planning, and now we're halfway through it. But so I mean, obviously, I talk about being a survivor. I was sexually abused by my uncle throughout my childhood, and it was so regular that I never realised initially when I was an infant, I suppose you'd call me, in primary school. I genuinely didn't know what was happening. I didn't even know it was wrong. And some people, their experience of abuse is like one violation or one incident, and it's traumatic and it's scary. For me, it was like, it was constant, and it was so regular that it wasn't ever scary. Like, literally. Like, you know, you see the movies of the door flies open and the kid screams. It was never that. It was just this kind of really mundane, depressing, inappropriate contact that my uncle would have with me, that I grew to really loathe and detest. But when it first started, I had no comprehension of what it was. So this went on through my childhood, and then when I was 13, and it was the 24th of March 1996 at around 4 o'clock, I stood up to him and I told him he couldn't touch me anymore. But that was between me and him. Still, nobody knew that he'd been doing this my whole childhood.
What made you decide to do that, to stand up for yourself?
Well, by that point, I was in high school, and I was just in second year at high school, and I'd been through puberty, and I kind of had a much better idea of what it was he was doing. And so when I was a young kid and I didn't know what it was, then I kind of just went along with it. And I kind of knew that what he was doing probably wasn't a good thing. And I had the vaguest understanding of sex and that this was probably a sexual thing. And being a Catholic household, we didn't talk about anything sexual. Like, my dad would turn the channel over if somebody kissed on the screen in a soap opera, you know, kind of thing. So I kind of knew that we shouldn't talk about this, or I shouldn't talk about this. But I think when I went through puberty and I had to share my entire puberty with my uncle, because he would just comment on everything, and you know, that kind of physical changes you're going through and all that kind of stuff that's supposed to be for everyone's life a very private journey. I never got to have any of those private moments privately, you know, so you take all of that. And when I was in high school, I think obviously I was physically bigger, and I think I was just braver, but I thought he was abusing me and no one else. I still didn't know that he'd abused three others. So, yeah, I think he used to live with my grandmother. He never married. He never had his own kids or anything. He looked after my grandmother, and they used to live around the corner, and then they moved down to Glasgow, because we lived in a kind of suburban town called East Kilbride. It was about 8 miles apart. So when he no longer lived around the corner, I could always avoid. I was getting better at avoiding having to get stuck with him, or allowing him to create scenarios when it was just us two. But that day, March 24th, he'd told me that our uncle, my other uncle, his brother, was going to be there, and that's why I went this time, because I thought, well, he's not going to do it with our other uncle there. And when I got to his house, then of course that had been another lie. That was just something he'd made up to get me on my own. So I was so angry about that, and angry at him, but angry at myself for letting him trick me. That I think I spent, you know, that was the last time he abused me. And it was one of the first times, it happened sometimes, but he, you know, he said to me after he'd finished doing what he was going to do to me, he said, right, you do me that now. Right. And I think because I was in high school and my friends, you know, everyone at that point was talking about, it's where you learn about other things like homosexuality and you learn all these things in a Catholic high school, and then that's seen as like really, really wrong to be in any way gay. And so my uncle's telling me, 13 years old, that I had to do these things to him now. I just refused. I was like, this isn't happening. So I stood up. And the most kind of, I say I stood up to him. I said that I didn't feel very well. And I put my clothes on, I went into the toilet. I looked out the window of his bathroom, which was about on the second floor. So a tenement flat is very high ceilings, and he was on the second floor. So I looked out the window and I thought, that's about 15 metres to jump. I was like, and I was only, you know, I was a very small kid, I was about 4 foot high. I was thinking, if I jump 15 metres, I'm going to break both my legs. And for me, the reason I didn't do that wasn't that, God, it would be really sore to break your legs. I would be like, well, everyone would ask me, why did you jump out the window?
Yeah.
And then I would be in trouble because, you know, I'd done that. And what I did was I went back into the living room, and he was one of those people who used to put all his empty his change in his pocket into a bowl. So there was always this bowl of change in his house. So I went into the living room, I grabbed a handful of change because I was going to have to get the bus back to my house, which was 8 miles away. But then he caught me trying to run out of his house. And then, so I was just trying to sneak out. I wasn't trying to be confrontational. I was just going to sneak out whilst he thought I was in the bathroom. But he caught me, and he caught my arm, pulled me back into his flat, nearly pulled my shoulder, my arm out of the socket, because I think he was so scared when he saw that I was running away. He panicked. And then I didn't have to say anything, because he realised that I wasn't happy. He realised that I wasn't going to put up with what he was doing to me anymore. He realised that I wasn't this little, you know, easily manipulated kid. And he kind of fell apart, and all I had to do was stand there, and he apologised for everything. He said the strangest things, like, he said, I only do those things to you because I love you. And when you're 13 and you're like, what? Yeah. Like, you know, that doesn't make any sense, because you're my uncle, and what you're doing to me was violently inappropriate, you know. I say violently inappropriate, it wasn't violent, it was, you know, it was affectionate and strange, so. Yeah, so after that, he drove me back to our house where I lived with my parents in East Kilbride in silence. He wanted to take me to see Toy Story that week. And our parting words, age 13, I just said, I don't want to go to the cinema. And what I wish I'd said was, I'm not going to the cinema, but I said cinema. I got it wrong. And he said, can we still be friends? And I shook my head. And he said, sort of friends. And I shook my head again. And that was it. Then he left my house, and my mum and dad, even though they were in the house that day, they weren't aware that there was any sort of anything going on between me and him that day. And then for the next 2 years, any time he brought my gran over, I would just, you know, make excuses or just not be there. I was a master of acting like everything was fine, because I believe that if I let anyone know that what he's done to me, or let anyone know that that's freaked me out or stressed me out, for some reason I believed that that would be my problem and my fault. And I don't think it's just a Catholic thing. I think it's a Scottish thing or a British thing, or even I'm seeing it in every country I walk to, this kind of facade that families try and keep together. Don't let anyone outside of your family know that, you know, everything's anything less than perfect. So, yeah. So for some reason, I basically spent my teenage years never acknowledging what happened. So this is a long answer to a short question. Yeah. But what happened was, 5 years ago, I'd still not really talked about it. My uncle was still free to abuse more kids if he wanted to. And I and the other three people he abused were kind of still struggling. I, you know, going to therapy, and I was, you know, on kids' TV every morning. it was just, and the other guys were you know, some medicated for depression, various problems they were experiencing. And I was like, why are we, what the victims? Why are we struggling so much? And the person who did this is just free to carry on and create more victims if they want. And I was like, this is crazy. So I went online and I found Stop the Silence. And they're called Stop the Silence, Stop Child Sexual Abuse. And that was like a light bulb moment, you know, because they're not called, you know, change the laws, catch paedophiles, stop child sexual abuse. They're called Stop the Silence, Stop Child Sexual Abuse. And it really, for me, that was it. The silence, I couldn't talk about this. None of the victims could talk about this, and the fact that we weren't talking about it meant we couldn't begin to process the trauma, and it meant that we couldn't stop him. You know, you're not going to stop these people if you don't point at what they're doing and talk about it immediately. So, yeah, so I wrote a play about it called To Kill a Kelpie, which is about two guys who've been abused in their childhood, and for the first time as adults they talk about it. And that was performed in Glasgow. And, we all, for the first time in my family, that play kind of catalysed the discussion within us. We all talked about it for the first time. And a bit like, you know, when you watch a soap opera and there's a caught death storyline, at the end of the episode there'll be a phone line that says, if you're affected by these issues, please call this number. I wanted to do that, so this was a play about, you know, victims of child sexual abuse, which there's a lot of that now, but 5 years ago it was quite, the audience was quite frozen by the content of the play. So I invited the Moira Anderson Foundation, who are, I'm an advisor to the board now, but at that point I hadn't met them. They're based in Airdrie, which is between Glasgow and Edinburgh. They give counselling for child and adult victims of child sexual abuse, also support to the families. They give legal advice as well as therapeutic counselling. They're incredible. So I basically invited the Moira Anderson Foundation to be part of the first production of To Kill a Kelpie. And they were, Sandra Brown, OBE, she's the founder, she donated some money to the production to help it go on with professional actors. And then she was there afterwards and did a post-show discussion. And it was that, it was cloaking the show in that kind of, obviously related charity, associating with a charity that meant that it was easy, a natural step for me and the guys to then talk about it and then press charges. And my uncle's now sitting in prison, and I don't know how longer we would have stayed silent if I hadn't written that play. I don't know how long would we have waited, how many more kids might he have victimised if we hadn't, you know, if we'd stayed silent. So the play that I wrote, that was inspired by the idea of Stop the Silence, I wrote to Dr. Pamela Pine and said, do you know, your play inspired me to, sorry, your organisation inspired me to write a play. And then I told her what happened, and she was delighted how the play, which is just a story, it's just a piece of art, catalysed real change in our lives. And then she took it and toured it across America. And what we saw was the same thing happened with audiences in San Francisco and Chicago and DC. Audiences after the play, Stop the Silence, Dr. Pine and myself, because I was in the play at that point, as an actor, we would talk to the audience, and we had people after every performance disclosing histories of abuse, sometimes for the very first time in their life. And sometimes, you know, one guy in San Francisco was like, 70 years old, and his brother was like 68 or something, and they'd never discussed it, but after seeing the play, apparently he went home and called his brother. And that for me was wonderful, that, you know, the story that they'd been inspired by, my experiences, was inspiring and changing other people's lives. And then Stop the Silence asked me to be the European ambassador. And I figured, well, if you're an ambassador for something, you know, for Stop the Silence, I suppose I should go around Europe and, you know, be a spokesperson, raise awareness, continue the work that we were doing with Kelpie. The Scottish government gave us some money to take Kelpie to New York. We did it off Broadway. And then my brothers and I made a film adaptation. My brother Eddie, he's a really talented filmmaker, shot To Kill a Kelpie, the movie, which I'm also in with Alan Lindsay, who was in the New York production. And so To Kill a Kelpie is now going into universities across America. Stop the Silence are going to be hosting that with post-show talks and continuing that kind of, you know, awareness and what would you call it? I can hear Dr. Pine annoyed at me as I forget how to describe this, but it's basically catalysing behavioural change within communities. You know, Kelpie, we did Stop the Silence conducted research before and after people watched it, and it not only helped people understand the issue of child sexual abuse and the related kind of fallout trauma and psychological devastation that's life-lasting in the victims. It also, the post-show discussion also catalysed people's intent to act and actually change their behaviour to prevent child sexual abuse. Which is great, because it was, you know, all of that from what is essentially a play or a piece of art, which is pretty cool. So, yeah, so they asked me to be the European ambassador, and I figured, well, I should go around Europe and continue this awareness raising and trying to create change. But I figured if I walk around Europe, if I walk, then I'll just attract more attention, because, you know, essentially I'm just an actor, writer from Scotland. There's no real reason foreign governments should listen to me. But I figured if I walk, then at least the media will want to speak to me. And if the media speak to me, then maybe I'll attract, you know, certain attention. And that's kind of what happened. After Luxembourg, when the British ambassador, Alice Walpole, walked with me, she got all the other British embassies to support Road to Change. And since then, it's just grown and grown and grown. That was a 15-minute answer.
It was more than that. It's like 17. Oh, well. So, Janet Simmons, I think she's from Sweden.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My Swedish sister.
How did you survive the abuse?
How did I survive the abuse? Yeah. It's, how I survived it whilst it was happening is different to how I survived it after it stopped happening. I think when I was a little kid, I survived it because I literally didn't know what was happening. I didn't understand what it was, and it really started to become something that I had to deal with when I understood what was going on, when I was about 10 or 11. You know, just as I was getting into puberty, and kids' awareness of sex and sexuality is really starting to form in their minds, that's when I was like, this is a sexual thing that my uncle's doing with me, and I'm not allowed to say anything, and I don't want him to do it. But I was completely trapped because, you know, he kept trapping me. And I couldn't talk about it because then I would be the troublemaker, and I would bring shame on the family if I brought this out in the open. So I was kind of stuck. So I tried various things in my mind psychologically to survive that. And I'll still say, you know, in my child logic, they were good at the time. But they really messed me up when it came to trying to deal with, you know, trying to move past it when I was older. Like, I remember in my head thinking, I was about 9 or 10 years old, and I was like, well, maybe I should just enjoy it because, you know, it feels nice, and it's probably no one else in my class gets this, you know, amount of sex. So maybe I should just close my eyes and try and, you know, try and not hate it, try and just enjoy the experience. And then, of course, that didn't quite work, because you can't take away the feeling of whilst it's happening of just wanting to be anywhere else. Another thing I tried to do was I think my uncle used to buy me a lot of things, you know. When we looked in the attic recently, people, because I was the youngest of 7 kids, people say, were you spoiled because you were the youngest? And I would always say no. But when I went to my mum and dad's attic, there was so much crap, you know, Lego and wrestling figures, all this stuff. And I was like, God, maybe I was spoiled. And then I realised my uncle, you know, he bought me all this stuff. probably to cover his own guilt. But then I remember trying to survive the situation. I was thinking, well, maybe I could profit out of this. Maybe I could, you know, I can probably get anything I want out of him because he'll, you know. So it wasn't rational, but I guess I kind of, I felt like I prostituted myself to at least get something out of this horrendous situation that I was trapped in. And of course that becomes, you know, a white elephant, all those toys and stuff. You're just stuck with them going, well, what was this worth, you know? But I'll say that how I survived it, and I'm a huge advocate for this, is I talked about it. The difference between me and the other people he abused, I think, was that when I was 17, I broke my silence. I kind of ran away from home. I took a volunteer job in Wolverhampton, and as fate would have it, my colleague Rachel, I don't know, I'd never told anyone in my life what my uncle had done. And I was 17, and I'd left home, and I just had to get out of that environment. And I went down there, and I met Rachel. And she something about Rachel, and if you ever meet her, you'll know what I mean. She just opens your heart, and you can just talk to her. She's an incredible human being, and she taught me a lot about so many things, actually. She, in a lot of ways, and when I look back at that point, I was on the run, and I was quite suicidal. And I'd never really been to therapy. I'd never talked about any of it. And something about her, she just brought that out of me, and she directed me towards counselling. I was 17 years old, so I started to talk about it. And I would say that's how I've never been medicated for depression, even though I have been suicidal, because I value the power of discussion, the power of talking about it. Because stop the silence isn't just about talking about it so we prevent it. It's talking about it so you can heal. And I would say if you're a survivor, and you've tried regular therapies, you've tried talking about it, and it's not working, the other thing I would recommend, which they're recommending to soldiers with PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress, is called transcendental meditation. So if you try transcendental meditation, is this sounds like hippie thing that people do, because I think the Beatles made it kind of popular in the 60s. But what that is a really simple way of relaxing your body in a deep, deep way, in a deep, deep kind of rest. And that if you're at a point where the memories, if you were to talk about the memories, it would trigger you and make you more upset, then transcendental kind of gets around that. I mean, there's doctors recommending it to people who've been in car accidents, because your human body and your mind, actually, if you remove any sort of stress, they can heal themselves, and that's what meditation does. You don't have to talk about it; you just deeply relax, and your mind and body can heal. So I would recommend those two things. But the power of talking about it is yeah, that's why I'm trying the first thing, trying to get everyone to talk about it.
Yeah. Abby Jane Butcher. Butcher, what gave you the courage to speak up?
What gave me the courage to speak up? I think, well, there's different levels of speaking up. There's the first time when I spoke up against my uncle, which was just out of sheer frustration and all those kind of things. When I spoke up to Rachel was... I would give her all the credit for me speaking up, because she just was so open. And you can do this. You can do this for anyone in your life. And Rachel taught me this expression called kind eyes. You look at anyone that Rachel meets, and she used to work, or she still works with teenagers, like teenage pregnancy prevention and all sorts of areas like that. She works with a lot of scared teenagers, so I think I was probably, you know, pretty within her realm of expertise when I met her. But she says, look at people with kind eyes. And that just means, you know, open yourself and be an open person. If there's anyone in your life, I don't think it's good to go up to someone and say, have you been sexually abused? But if you soften yourself and just create an environment where kids or adults or friends or anyone in your life knows that you can be a person they can come to. And don't worry about that. You know, if a kid or an adult or anyone comes to you and gives you this information, they're not putting it on you. Like, you don't have to take on the weight of that. You can just help direct them towards services that do exist. And there are, you know, honestly, if you're listening to this from the UK, I can't articulate to you how lucky you are to be in that environment with all those services. Because here where I am in Bulgaria, there's millions of victims here and they don't have those community-based services. They don't exist here yet. And they're a long way from existing. And that's really sad to witness as a survivor. But, you know, we are here trying to change that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, what gave me the courage to speak up? I think when I looked at the other victims, it wasn't so much... I mean, it's hard to look at yourself and stamp your foot and say, this shouldn't happen to me. It's easier for me when I looked at the other people he'd abused and see what how they were struggling, and for me to go, that's not right. They shouldn't have to put up with this suffering. This wasn't their fault. And it was kind of the injustice of what happened to them that kind of made me speak out.
Yeah. Peter Mellon, what are the plans for when you return? Do you feel like you've gained enough support on your travels to really put pressure on the current setup here to make a lasting change?
When we get back, you know, we've created discussion at a governmental level in about 5 countries. Mm. We've motivated change in Slovakia, as we know, at a policy level, and in the Baltic states. We've catalysed a whole load of international collaborations with NGOs and... you know, individually, lots of survivors from across the continent have got in touch. And there's about 3 criminal investigations that have happened as a result of the walk, I guess. And that's wonderful, but it's not enough when you look at the scale of the problem. There's like 100 million victims, and like I've now seen many of them in situations where they're quite far away from help. So when we get back, I think the plan is to, plan B, is to go to the European Parliament, start to collect 1 million signatures across Europe. And that's, you know, whilst I'm walking, I'm meeting these NGOs and I'm looking for individuals who can be part of that committee. I need to get 7 EU countries to join me on the committee, and then we need to start looking for European signatures. And try and, you know, because that's what the government, Ministry of Justice in Bulgaria said, look, if the European Parliament said we had to change this, of course we'll adhere to that. But, you know, what they didn't say was, we're not going to listen to this actor from Scotland telling us how to run our country. And so I was like, okay, I'll go. It was almost like a really polite challenge. It was like, you know, go to the European Parliament, and if you can convince them of your logic, then fine. So that's the plan when I get back.
Janet Stewart, how do you feel that you've made a difference? How do you feel that you've made a difference to so many? Gave them strength to carry on. Let the voices be heard, especially now that children are aware of the road to change and know you by this and not just from the kids' TV programme.
It's hard. How does it feel? I think it's nice that the mess that my uncle created in the world, and it's hard to quantify the devastation and the lives that he and his actions affected, and the kind of perpetual misery that abusers manifest in the lives of everyone that they abuse, and also the people who care about the victims, and it goes on for generations, you know, like. And like I say, it's hard to really quantify all of the damage. But to think that somehow something positive came out of all that, what happened in my childhood is now being transformed into awareness, and there's now kids in communities, and there's you know, that's a wonderful feeling to think that I can't do anything about what happened, but I can do something about what I do with what happened, you know. So that's, it's nice, but at the same time, it's like I don't want to be. Do you know what I mean? It's like this celebrity victim. What's it gonna be like when I come at home from Road to Change and everyone's like, oh, there's that guy that was abused. I guess that's. Part of the mission isn't just to identify myself as someone who was abused, it's to try and change the perception of people who have been abused. You know, there's a friend of ours who's a big supporter of Road to Change called Kenton, Kenton Sparks was talking to me about how the word survivor is a very interesting word, because it's kind of reserved for survivors of, like, the Holocaust or of a natural disaster or of cancer. But people who have survived sexual violence are still called victims. In most countries, you know, in most languages in Europe, they don't even use the word survivor. It doesn't apply to adult victims of childhood sexual abuse. And why is that? And it would seem that if someone's a survivor of some great evil, like the Holocaust, then society can look at that and go, obviously, that wasn't your fault. You shouldn't have had to go through that. You shouldn't feel guilty or feel responsible for what happened to you. And there's a dignity in being a survivor of those things. And why don't we afford the same grace to people who are victims of sexual violence? You know, very often they're depicted on television, they change their voice, their faces are kind of darkened out. And there's no dignity in that, you know. And I think I spent my early childhood with my uncle taking away my dignity, and I think it's nice to think that I get to take some of that back. Yeah. You know? So, yeah, that's how it feels.
Janet Simmons, have you ever heard of a case that a child saying it's been abused just to get noticed?
Yeah, it does happen, but not as much as people think, and not as much as the media jumps on. I know there's a case in Sweden at the moment where a girl abused her father, and then I think as Janet explained, he served 9 years of a 10-year sentence.
He served 10 years out of a 12-year sentence.
Yeah,
and he's not guilty.
And now they found out he's not guilty. Yeah. There's a case recently. It was in Britain where a woman, she's now going to serve nearly a year in prison for making 2 false rape allegations. And it's one of those things, because, like, I'm walking around Europe to encourage, there's approximately, you know, 100 million people in this continent who are being sexually abused or victims of sexual violence. I'm not encouraging anyone to lie. I'm encouraging all of these people to tell the truth, you know, for their benefit and for the benefit of you know, preventing future victims. But what happens and what the research has shown is that, you know, that I think the Canadian research is the one that I've seen. And 100% of cases reported by children were found to be true. 98% of cases reported by adults were found to be true, and that 2% were falsified were divorcing parents trying to discredit each other. And I think that's the rub. You know, this is a horrendous thing to accuse someone of, because mud sticks and society's panic. You know, there's hysteria around making these allegations at the moment, which I think we need to find that equilibrium about it. You know, we need to stop panicking so much and getting so hyped up when someone even talks about these things. And I'm sure if this guy's already served nearly 10 years, then that was 10 years ago in Sweden. And these kind of cases 10 years ago were very new. Legislation has advanced since then.
Yeah.
People's, and even social workers and police understanding of these situations in you know, North and Western Europe is far more advanced in the last decade. So hopefully those kind of situations where innocent people are ended up incarcerated, that's not going to happen so much, or at all, you'd hope. But, you know, it's trying to educate kids that they have a voice, that these things shouldn't be happening to them, and that they must speak if this does happen to them. But, and at the same time, educate them that it's a criminal offence to, you know, to make up these things. So they understand the severity of these things. If it's happening to them, they must speak about it. And if it's not happening to them, you know, it would be a terrible crime and a terrible, terrible thing to invent these things. Mostly because when the media gives so much time and so much coverage to false cases, it means that when someone has a genuine case, it creates that stigma that, oh, is it real? You know, when, like, the research has shown that if the kid is making the allegation, then kids don't have any way of making this stuff up. They don't have an idea what sex is. So if they're describing these things, they've learned it from somewhere. So it is a real situation.
Peter Mellinigan, what is the strangest sight you've seen on your travels?
Oofed.
Oofed.
We see some strange things, Stigo, don't we?
Oh, we do. Like all the horse carriages here. I mean, that's a pretty normal thing here for them.
The horse carriages, I mean, the Roma community in these Balkan the Balkans. These countries are really interesting. I remember it was specifically 23 kilometres outside Bucharest, and I'm walking down the side of a very busy motorway. And there was a family on a horse and cart coming towards me. The horse started getting a bit freaked out because I think a motorbike or something went past the horse. This is a horse and cart on the main carriageway.
Yeah, and it's like that everywhere, even in the capital. So
it's just kind of, it wouldn't happen in Britain.
Nah.
But the horse got a bit freaked out. So who I imagined was the mother of this family, and the kids are in the back in the cart. She jumped down and she grabbed the horse's bridle to try and calm the horse down. But I think if a horse is freaking out, grabbing its head isn't going to calm it down. So to as a kind of second resort, she picked up some pretty big rocks, and from about a metre away, she threw them at the horse's head, which looked extremely painful. And, you know, throwing a brick at a horse's head from a metre away, it just kind of bounced off its skull, and the horse then went mental. And then started running. But, of course, this horse had her kids in the back. I just watched it going, what are you doing? It's like, in what world would that be the solution to a horse's freaking out, so let's throw a brick at its head when my kids are strapped to the horse? You know? And so then the horse went off running down the road with these kids hanging on for their life down a motorway. I was just insane. I thought, you know, what is that? That was pretty strange.
Strange, yeah.
But I think the strangest thing that I've heard when we were in Bucharest as well, Romania is a beautiful country. I'm not discrediting Romania, but two of the most unusual things I've seen were in Romania. We did a screening of To Kill a Kelpie, and afterwards we spoke to the audience. And they told me about a practice here. And it's not just in Romania, but they said it was Central Europe. They said this, and literally my jaw hit the floor. I'd never heard of this. But basically, for young mothers who have a baby son who's not sleeping, who won't go to sleep and he's crying and making a lot of noise, apparently there's an old wives' practice of, how would you even say this? It's basically just masturbating the child, and if it's a boy, and that would then make him happy and go to sleep. So I mean, I was like, what? And they were like, yeah, this happens. And I didn't witness it. They just told me that this is a practice somewhere here, and they weren't even specific about where. They just said Central Europe. That was so in my head. What? I think I was trying not to, you know, I was trying to be like, oh, okay, that's interesting. But that for me is abusive. But then if that's a practice that's been going on since the dawn of time, then who am I to come over here with my Western sensibility and say that's abuse? Because if, you know, I mean, it's one of those moments when I was just like, oh my God, I don't know what to think about that.
Yeah.
And I don't even want to speak because I need to process this first. So that was pretty weird. But Stego, this is, I knew this would happen when I started talking about these things, it would get a bit long.
So. Yeah, that's fine. I think most people just listen to the radio.
Yeah, but we'll talk more about it next week, especially about there's other aspects about the Road to Change which are particularly crazy. But Mandy Bobs is ahead of us. We are just in about an hour. We're going to cross into. And sent us a wee update, so let's hear from her now.
Hello from Athens. Standing on the balcony just now, in the sunshine, looking at the coast. So lovely to be here. I've been looking forward to this part of the journey since it came out. It's nice to see the sea again. Good timing as well with the sun. So I got here late on Tuesday night. Been here for a couple of days, catching up with paperwork and doing the tracking and follow-up, which is collecting information from the various different people that Matt's dealt with on the journey, and tracking how much change has been made since his visit. The journey here was it was another belter, actually. On Tuesday morning when I woke up in Sofia, my whole face was swollen. My right eye was completely, almost shut over. Gabby, the last couch surfer host that I stayed with at this place, she was trying to be polite about it and help, but she like couldn't look away, and she was like inching closer to me to try and inspect what was wrong. We didn't know, but anyway, I had the bus to catch at 9 o'clock, so 9 a.m. So I had to go. Couldn't worry about it. I was walking about the bus station with this strange face and weighed down by all these bags, talking a foreign language. And, yeah, I was the girl that nobody wanted to talk to or help, so that was great. Yeah, it turned out it was an insect bite. I could feel a little itchy lump in my eyebrow. About halfway there, I realised I must have had an allergic reaction to some sort of bite. So, yeah, I had some antihistamines on me, thankfully. I took one of them and that helped. But it was one of those heavy-duty ones. It makes you drowsy. So by the time I arrived at the Greek border in the bus, not only was I the girl with the talking in a foreign language with a puffy eye and a strange face, but I was the girl whose eyes were rolling back in her head with all the bags, talking in a foreign language with a puffy eye. So, yeah, I ended up staying overnight in Thessaloniki, a place at the border of Greece, because I couldn't face another five-hour train journey in Athens, like, looking and feeling like that. And then going to meet a couch surfer host at the other end. Like, hello, aren't you glad you met me? I'm going to stay in your house now. The embassy, the person I deal with at the embassy here, the head press and communications, is on leave this week, so I'm having to do a lot of the groundwork myself, approaching, because we've got three avenues that we try to cover in every country: the awareness raising through press and media, the collaborating with NGOs, and the change that we want to make happen through the ministries and the MPs, the political side of things. So I'm going to have to do the outreach to them myself this week, which means I'll have less time to get the footage and the photos that I get along the road to document the journey as I go. I came up with an idea a while ago upon doing some research online about child sexual abuse across the EU. I came across something quite interesting that I want to implement into the trip, let's see.
Cheers, Mandy Bob. So we'll see you in probably, I'll see you in about 2 weeks.
Oh, 10, 11, 12 days, something like that.
I'm supposed to be there in 14 days. It'll probably take me 12 days to actually walk there.
Hit the coast soon.
Yeah.
That'll be fun. We haven't seen the coast since Latvia.
Since the Baltic Sea. Which one's the Mediterranean Sea? Or the Black Sea? I don't, on that side.
No, yeah, I'm not sure which one it is. I think
my geography gets better as I go. I don't know until I get there.
Yeah. But so according to the forecast, it's going to be quite good weather when we get down there.
I don't look at the forecast because I'm going to walk in it whatever it is, so it doesn't really matter.
No,
but great. Have we got any luck of the week, Stegel?
Yeah. See, today we plan to just cross the border and go into Greece and then do another 10 or 15 just down the road. And we had all the map planned out and stuff. But this morning we checked the GPS in my phone and it was like gave us a strange relocation, so we had to go around it like 15 kilometers around it. Well, that was a bit strange, so I didn't think that would happen, but yeah, we had to drive around on an old road because that road that's on the GPS is not even built yet. It's just a
It makes me nervous when you say we had to drive around. You had to drive around. I had
to walk an extra 15 kilometers.
So basically, the road was closed.
The road was closed, and we had to do it another 15 kilometers around it. It's like
15 kilometers is basically
10 miles.
Yeah, but it's also about 2.5 hours for me. So the road was closed. My phone had died. Stiggle, I couldn't alert you to the fact that the road was closed. So I was going to I'm going to have to follow this diversion. Even though I probably could walk across a closed road, because you can't follow me though. Yeah. So that was it. Phone was dead, and so I should have been in Greece earlier, but we're going to go now. So I'll be in Greece in about an hour, because I've already done the 2 hours extra walking now. But we wanted to get this podcast in before it gets too late. So thank you so much, guys, for listening.
Yep, thank you.
And I want to say, If you're listening to this podcast, you're obviously someone who enjoys a podcast, so I've got a recommendation for you, especially if you're a survivor of child sexual abuse, or if you know someone, or actually if you're just anyone who just, you know, in life who likes a podcast. I've been listening to The Mental Illness Happy Hour with Paul Gilmartin. It's an incredible podcast. It's been going for about 3 years, and he's a comedian in America. Most of the guests are kind of celebrities or comedians in America, but he gets people as well from all walks of life, and it's just like an hour or two of them talking about what they struggle with in their life. Obviously, it's called The Mental Illness Happy Hour, but it's not like just people who are schizophrenic and that kind of stuff. It's people who maybe have depression, or they're struggling with a past trauma, a sexual trauma from their childhood, any of those kind of things. So it's called The Mental Illness Happy Hour. Check it out on iTunes, and or just search for Paul Gilmartin. I think the website's called mentalpod.com, and you'll find it there. So check that out. And also, if you're in Scotland, or if you're anywhere in the world, listen to the Janie Godley podcast with Ashley Story and Janie Godley. We love that. That keeps me up to date on what's going on back home. And Janie is also a survivor, and just an incredible voice for the people. So check that out. It's incredibly funny as well. So, yeah, thank you so much for listening.
Thank you.
As you know,
it's a bit long, but
a bit long, but you know, the road to change is an It's a walk. It's a 10,000-mile walk around Europe, organised and supported by Stop the Silence, Stop Child Sexual Abuse, in partnership with the Moira Anderson Foundation, two incredible organisations who have really, in many ways, enriched my life. So if you want to support the walk, which would be awesome, because we've got a long way to go.
Yeah.
It's roadtochange.eu, and you can find out where I've been and where I'm going next and all that kind of stuff. But until next week, when we'll be in Greece, thanks for listening.
Thanks. See you.